This is Dee Blick. Welcome to Lead Well, Live Well for UK Health Radio. Hello and a warm welcome to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick, on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station. And it is a scorching day here in the UK. We're set for another heat wave. I don't know what it's like where you're based, but it's certainly going to be a hot one today. Now, I'm delighted that in the studio today, there's a guy that I don't know him very well, but what I do know about him, I was so impressed when I met him properly at a conference I was speaking at a few weeks ago. And I just thought I absolutely must have him on the show because of his passion, his enthusiasm. He's a dad to be, which naturally he's incredibly excited about. And we're going to touch on that in the show. So a warm welcome to you, James Sundin.
Dee, thank you so much for having me. And what a wonderful way to open this. Thank you so much. Kind words, very, very kind words indeed.
It's a pleasure. Now, I know that you are something of a sales guru. I know that not just from what you say, but from what your clients say. So we're going to be talking about that later in the show, because mastering the art of selling without being pushy in sales is something that everybody, in my opinion, if they run a business or they're in a function in the business where they have to generate sales, then I think you're going to have some really wise nuggets and sound bites that I'm very keen to extract from you. But I just want to really talk about, you've got a business, Represent, which you co-founded. And before we talk about that, can you just give us a little insight into your early career and what brought you to your business, Represent?
Yeah, I mean, how early, how far back should we go, really? I think very humble beginnings, Dee. I started in commission-only door-to-door sales. So a lot of people think sales is hard, or even certain people in a sales role or quota-carrying role think it's hard. And the only thing I would give as advice to anyone of that ilk that's really, really thinks they're having a nice, tough time at the moment, go and walk around in the cold and wind and rain. Go and do that in the northeast of England, one of the most, or if not the most economically deprived area of England. And go and do that on commission only, whereby if you don't sell, you don't eat. That is hard sales. And that's, I guess, where I started. I have always been a grafter, Dee, so from very, very humble beginnings, as kind of mentioned, I kind of just continued to put myself out there, rejection after rejection. I managed to get a role with a great software company, very well known, called Sage. Did a phenomenal job at Sage, worked my way up, and I've been basically headhunted by company after company for what has been now the last 12 years. Of being in the accounting and finance industry. So I've done various different things. I've managed Scotland and managed kind of larger territories for companies like Sage. I went into the new business team at Iris Software, which are a multi-billion pound global company. I've won awards for my ability where it comes to not being salesy, but empowering individuals' buying decisions. I spent 3 years in practice at a company called McAlvin's Group, and then went, hey, I think there's something potentially missing within the market here from a vendor side. There's something I want to be expanded into. And the idea for Represent was born.
Wow. Do you know, you had me at door knocking and commission only sales, because I truly believe that if you can master the art, it's managing the rejection, the negativity, but still flourishing. That to me shows a tenacity, a resilience, and a perseverance that's the, for me, the fundamental bedrock of being able to sell, because I so identify with you. Because when I, going back to my sales career, that mine really took off when I was cold selling jewelry and a brand called Tupperware. And I totally get it with you. There's nothing like having a cold audience, and you know you have to win them over to make anything. And I did exactly that. So I just think it is brilliant, that you started off, because that is the absolute basis to me of being able to sell. It's like you'll never have a situation as challenging as that knocking on doors. And how did you manage that? Because I often think with sales that I'm a marketer who loves to sell, which is quite unusual. And I think that's attributed a lot to my success. But how long were you doing the door to door, and how did you manage your emotions? Because I would imagine that door after door after door, you're getting these rejections. So managing yourself and your emotions is going to be massive.
Absolutely. I think the first thing, so around kind of 18 months, 18 months towards 2 years, I was involved, whether that be I just started, I was learning the ropes, or building and scaling a team of people beneath me. So thinking about that whole kind of commission-only pyramid side of things, I started to move up the pyramid. I, at one point, had the largest team within the organization that I was working for. So I personally taught and mentored all of these individuals. And this was like the age of 18, 19 years old, when I was all just still figuring it out, wet behind the ears, right? I think, how do you get through it? A terminology that is used within that part of the industry, and any of your listeners that have been involved in door-to-door themselves will be familiar with the term negging out, whereby an individual's attitude diminishes to such a level that regardless of the number of people that you knock on, get answers from, or speak to, because you are taking that negative attitude into that conversation, it's ultimately not going to yield anything. So to avoid negging out, I would have a competition with myself. So I became very good at sensing micro-expressions within people's faces, their body language, their posture. Ultimately, if they're going to be receiving to, you know, hearing about what I'm canvassing, what I'm talking about, what I've knocked on their door to speak about, depending on what that project may have been. I was very, very good at spotting that. And I would kind of preemptively say, get it, it's not for you. And I've had this competition with myself that I would be out of their garden. I would shut the gate nice and gently. Obviously, you don't want to be rude. And I would be going down to the next door neighbor's front door. I would be doing all of that before they'd even shut the door. That way I knew I could get around 500 doors in a day. I could get around each door twice, if not three times. And that would then yield my 5, 6, 7, 8, in some cases, 9 or 10 sales in a day. So that for me was, I need to protect my energy. I need to be able to protect my mindset. I need to stop myself from negging out. And you know what it is, Dee? That's like such a small thing. But that is relevant, not just for people knocking on doors. That's every aspect of life, whether you're in sales, whether you're not. If you can stop yourself from negging out and you can keep that positive mindset and positive attitude in whatever you do in life, your relationship with your partner, your relationship with your kids, your work life and your relationship with your colleagues or even your customers, you know, that's half the battle. What's up here? That's ultimately what dictates success as far as I'm concerned.
I absolutely love what you shared there, and I agree with every single word of it. I think our mindset, the way we manage ourselves when we're going through the storm, not when the sun's shining and everything's rosy. And I can see how you are so successful now, because you came from that humble beginning. You knew what the ignominy of rejection was like, and you knew what you had to do to preserve yourself and maintain your positive attitude. And I think that so many successful people in sales have had humble beginnings, and I did that too. And then I went on to manage a team of women, and we built a business to £1 million in a year. And that was cold calling, that was using the telephone. And I started out doing it, had to learn what rejection was like, how to manage the objections. And then I brought a team of women into the business. But I always look back on that as being the absolute basis from which I was subsequently able to become what I call a sales-driven marketer. And we've got a minute before the break, and so I want us to carry on chatting about this after the break, because I think you've tapped into a rich seam of revelation that so many of my listeners will find so useful. That I want to know that you got Represent, which you co-founded. What are the business lessons and insights that you brought to the table when you co-founded Represent? And why did you, you know, was it, there's two bits to this question. Did you want to just float your own boat? You saw a gap in the market and you knew that you could fill it. So maybe if we look at the first bit is, what did you bring to the table when you decided to co-found Represent? And maybe after the break, I want to talk about why, because I'm always interested in an entrepreneur's why, their journey. So shoot with that first part of the question.
Yeah, sure. So I think 12 years worth of experience is where I'm at now. So at the point where founding the business, 9 years worth of multi-award winning experience where it comes to sales, marketing and growth, specifically focused in on accountants in practice, I guess, is what I brought to the table. Some of my co-founders might say a tenacity and a self-belief, which is verging on the line between insanity and genius. I would have thought one of my co-founders in particular, Antoinette, would say that. I think she'd probably lead towards more along the side of insanity. But I think for anyone, dear, you're like, everything's a stupid idea until it works, right? So I think that a self-belief, the unwavering commitment to something much bigger, I think that's been very, very solid as a foundation, of which we've scaled on very, very rapidly from day one. And, you know, every rock band needs a front man, right? Or a front woman for that matter. So we've got both in our organization, but working in different ways. So everyone needs a rock star and everyone needs the person who's crazy enough to go and get it.
Yeah, I love that. Well, don't go away because we're moving to a short break. And then I'm going to be chatting more to James about what was the gap that he saw in the market and the initial challenges that he faced with his new business.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick, and I've got the fabulous James Sundin talking sales on today's show. Now, James, tell me, why did you found Represent? Did you see a gap in the market? And also you mentioned accountants, so I'm guessing there that you're choosing to focus. So could you share a bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So accountants are a 1/4 of the industries that we work with. So accountants in practice, finance leaders in industry, SaaS businesses, but also we work with regulators as well on various different things that we do. Keeping it succinct as possible, though, you know, I'm kind of focusing on accountants. One of the frustrations, I think, two parts to this. Number one is a personal frustration. Accountants are absolutely fabulous at what they do. They, and good ones, can genuinely impact a small business owner's life in such an incredible, incredible way. But they're absolutely terrible at talking about it. So a lot of the things that I've done over the last 12 years have been supporting accountants where it comes to delivery of service, right? Which is then reliant on the accountant winning that business Otherwise, as a vendor in that space, you're reactive to that change, i.e. you can't do anything other than fulfill the demand for the supply which has been created by your client. And I guess from my, you know, 3 years as chief commercial officer in what is now a top 80 firm in the UK, I kind of learned sales, not just how to sell to a firm, how to understand a firm, but more importantly, more relevant for our services now, how firms can help to differentiate themselves, be known by their ideal clients, win that business. And I was kind of like, hey, like the gap in the market here is, yeah, some of these things are dealt with by individual vendors, but a lot of people come in and go, here's what I do, here's my pitch, do you need that? Yes or no, thanks very much, see you later. As opposed to coming in and going, hey, like, where are you now? Where do you want to be? What's holding you back? And every single consultation, call, meeting I've had over the last 2.5 years, there hasn't been a single firm that we're not able to make a positive impact within D. And I think because we have a full spectrum and a full suite, regardless of the problem that a firm has, the problem that they want to create by firstly fixing the problem that they don't want to have, it leaves us in a very unique situation in the market whereby our clients really value what we're doing from that full life cycle perspective. So two parts to it. Number one, huge gap in the market. Secondly, a frustration that accountants can be better than what they say they are. They can articulate their value in a better way. And that as a result of, we can support them with that, but then also fulfill on what they're going to need post-winning that work, which is ultimately delivery of that service.
Okay, so can I've worked with accountants, so I really understand what you are saying. So let me dig a bit deeper into the how. Do you support them with training, with mentoring, with actually doing the sales calls for them, with marketing? It'd be really interesting to share how your support manifests itself through to the different channels.
All of the above. To every point you just mentioned there, all of the above. Where it comes to certain types of delivery, for example, things like hosting the actual website itself. So we work with third parties. Those can either be partners that we've worked with, but ultimately, whether it's the copywriting, video editing, whether it is the sales systems, processes, the automations that are set up, whether it's consulting, where it comes to things like GEO, SEO, pay-per-click, we've got like a full roster of a team available. And it's only the final kind of end bits, the hosting of the domain, actually taking the design as to what's been done and putting that on the website. As of right now, those are the only parts that we're not necessarily involved with. For a lot of our clients, I'm involved in things like sales training for them and their team. Sales within accountancy is a very interesting one. It's for a lot of people in a larger firm, great, you've made partner, go and sell. I've never sold before. I've been a client manager. I've got no idea what I'm doing, but apparently I need to go and figure it out. Great. That's the realization for a lot of people. And others, sales is constraint to founders. You know, you've got one or two founders within a business. Those are the only individuals that can be involved in sales-related conversations. So a lot of the work that we do is around upskilling the right team member that really wants to be involved in commercial conversations, and making sure that they've got the confidence, the right processes, the right systems, the right, I guess, fire and desire to be able to do these things. And that takes away the founder bottleneck and, I guess, one of the sweet spots of our kind of growth or win services.
It's an interesting one because I spent 3 years working with a five practices firm of accountants. And what I found was that they lent on networking, which I think is fantastic, you know, going to networking groups. But it was trying to get them to envision a world beyond networking in terms of bringing potential new clients on board. And I did quite a few events for them. I did like branding masterclasses. I arranged lunch clubs where they could then meet informally with targeted people because they hadn't thought before. I was like, well, we've got some great local venues. Don't just do networking. Bring people that you want to build relationships with into your brand. And that in itself was a bit of an epiphany for them because you're right. You're not talking to an audience for whom selling comes easy. If anything, selling is a bit of a dirty word that they shy away from. So I think that having somebody like you, James, first of all, to make them realize that sales is part of the process, it's part of the growth of the business. And I think I liked you saying that you deliver sales training, whether you call it that or not, because I found that when I worked with this team that they really did need some form of it was confidence building as well, because I think you alluded to that, but accountants are not used to selling. They really want to be behind their desk, maybe go to a lunchtime networking group or an early morning one, come back and crack on. And so I can imagine just how popular and how needed your services are. But I want to talk now a bit more about, I love it when I have guests on my show that they're always really honest. I love what you're sharing, and it all sounds really hunky-dory. But I guess I want to find out, what were the initial challenges that you faced with your new business? Because none of us are impenetrable. We all have our little glitches. We all have the small things that can threaten to derail us, but we don't let them. So I want to know that what initial challenges, I told you I fluffed my words, what initial challenges did you face with your business and how did you overcome them?
I guess two points to this, Dee. Number one is more of a business side. The other one is probably more of a personal side, right?
Yes.
So I think from a business side, and as a marketer, you'll potentially really, really appreciate this, right? Where it comes to sales, growth, marketing, a lot of the advice comes around pick a niche, stay with that niche, talk about that niche, talk about it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again until you're remembered for that specific thing that you do. Where we launched, I decided to do the exact opposite. I wanted to intentionally confuse our ICP, and it really worked. And the reason
why... So ICP mean? What does ICP mean?
Great question. Ideal client profile. So let's be mindful of the sales and marketing anagrams, I guess, as we go through. But so we intentionally wanted to confuse our ideal client profile. We did so because we were sharing results that we had with some incredibly influential, very well-known brands and firms. And that kind of led to people saying, oh my God, who are these guys? What are they doing? Which actually spread our brand awareness. If not, and if they were talking to other people that didn't know what we actually did, they would then come to us and self-generate themselves as a lead, right? Because they're really, really interested. That is what a lot of people would consider the most backward marketing plan. It took a while to be able to get traction within the market. However, yes, once people really get and understand and see, because they came and had that conversation with you, that it took longer to be able to gain that traction momentum than it would have been if we were, you know, making it super, super clear for one particular industry, one particular vertical, one particular service. But I think that was a bit of an issue, especially in the early days, right? You know, that kind of led to, you know, cash reserves to being depleted. I was, give or take, about a week away from being bankrupt, hadn't paid myself anything in the first 9 months of us starting. And, you know, that inevitably had an impact with cash flow and money coming into the business, because we didn't do one thing for one market in one industry, and we started it in a different way. I think from a personal perspective, Dee, where we first started, so myself and Antonessa, who's my IOG, if you would, you know, my OG co-founders, me and Anto kind of decided to do this, and we brought everyone in from there onwards. But when we first started, it was 14, 15, 16-hour days, six, if not 7 days a week for the first 6 months. And it pushed me personally, mentally, to the point of breaking or getting very, very close to it. Thankfully, my wife, Leah, just an incredible woman. She could see the vision and desire and everything else around it, but it really put a huge strain on our relationship. And then from there, it was kind of like, right, well, let's build those foundations. Let's get the stability. Let's work out what the rules of play are around work and life outside of work, you know, this beautiful thing outside of work called life. Yes. You know, let's understand those and let's better understand each other through that process. Because, yeah, I really, really did push it towards breaking point. And I think that did, it took its toll, you know, professionally as well as personally as well.
I really appreciate your honesty, and I've yet to meet an entrepreneur, a successful entrepreneur, that has not gone through that really hard and challenging gestation period where you launch, you've got your vision, then the hard yards have to start and you have to be adaptive as well. And of course, that has an impact on us personally and professionally. And when you were sharing that, I was thinking, gosh, all that experience of knocking on those doors and getting rejections must have really helped you, you know, help fortify your resilience. Now we're just coming up to the second break. Don't go away, because I'm going to be talking to James about imposter syndrome and fear of failure. And also I want him to share some of his fabulous sales tips. So if you're in a situation that you really need to be going for something and the gap is that you need to have some great tips on how to convert, sell, win more in those meaningful conversations. And I'm sure you'll find James' tips really helpful.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick, and I've got the fabulous James Sundin in the studio today. So James, you were talking really candidly about the challenges you faced when you launched Represent, you're the co-founder of it. Something that I always talk to guests about, probably because it resonates with me, is imposter syndrome and fear of failure. And I just wonder, you sound so confident. Is this something that you have ever struggled with or had to face?
No, Dee. It would make me so much more relatable, human. But I have to be honest, absolutely not. There has been no fear of failure. There has been no imposter syndrome. It hasn't been a thing of entitlement and I'm this good or anything else, but it's never been a thing of doubting myself. Very much so, you know, people may be familiar with the analogy horse with blinkers on. Yeah. In order to, I guess, feel like an imposter in a situation, you need to perceive what others are doing and where you think you should be. This is my own interpretation of it anyway. Yeah. But you need to have a grounding as to what other people are doing, where they're at, and what point they were in their life and their career when they got to 1 million, 2 million, 5 million, whatever that number is, right? And I don't care. I don't pay any attention to anybody else. I don't look at competitors. I don't look at what other people have done before my age, before the age of 35 in their careers. Well, that's great. I respect it. Like, you know, especially great professionals of that have worked really, really hard and, you know, made something incredibly successful for their work life and life outside of that. But I've been solely focused on us and what we're doing and how we're doing it. That it's not given me the basis to say, oh, maybe I shouldn't be at this position and maybe I shouldn't be in this way. I think it's not the common, I guess, but being truthful and being direct, it's never been there. Where it comes to fear of failure, I mean, let me give you an analogy here, right? And this isn't just relevant for business. This is life outside of that.
Yeah.
Something that you might be fearful happening in the future. So in business, I don't make that amount of sales. My business runs out of cash. I need to let employees go. I need to close the business. That's worst case scenario. Great. Well, if you've got that potential problem, Are you worrying about it now, which is going to deplete your energy for when and if you actually have to deal with that, so you're going to be a lesser version of yourself? Or are you turning around and going, hey, that's a potential risk. What can I do about that in a positive way to impact that now? But being mindful that you're not worried about it and you're not depleting your energy. Like, whether it's business related or it's personal related, the way I choose to do it is, and it is an active conscious choice, and it has taken many, many, many years in order for me to kind of fortify this resilience mentally. But the way that I'd look at it is, why would I approach a difficult situation with depleted mental energy? Therefore, the outcome of that is more likely to be a negative one, as opposed to maintaining that positive attitude, seeing what I can do as practical steps to alleviate that issue arising in the future.
Yeah.
And then if it does come up, I'm 10 out of 10, 100% strength, and I can actually approach it in a way where I'm going to be able to overcome it.
I think that's fantastic. You reminded me of I had a guy, Richard Betts, who came on my show in the early days, and he said he didn't have fear of failure or imposter syndrome. And what I really got from that, I love that phrase about depleted mental energy, that if you're going into something, it's so much about your mindset. And I can see how you have been so successful in the most challenging of situations by bringing that positive, not depleted, mental attitude to bear. And I want to talk now about your business, Represent. And you spoke to me earlier in the show about the services that you offer, but I'm more interested in what's their biggest itch that you scratch. So is there something that time and time again you can see there's a fundamental need for the magic elixir that you are going to offer them? Because I get it that you offer a whole range of services. I've done the same as a marketer, but I can say, for example, with my clients, it's been an audit of their marketing, because it's like, why is our marketing not working? And I can look at it and tell them in minutes why their marketing is not working. And the second thing is, they need a really practical plan. So of all the things I've offered over the 40 odd years, they're the two things that I keep coming back to. Now, they don't come to me with that. They come to me with, we don't know how to do marketing. And then I go in, so, well, let's look at what you're doing and what's not working. And then let's look at how we can make it work. And you're the expert here. You're being parachuted in with this incredible experience, this incredible outlook. But it's really down to you. They might be saying one thing, but you can look at it and say, actually, there's a bigger issue here. So I'd like us to explore that dynamic a bit more.
I think the real big sweet spot, and you can boil it down to three things, Dick. You can boil it down to three things, D, even. We'll correct myself there. You did say sometimes we fluff with our words. There you go. I thought I'd just do one. Just it makes the whole thing flow better. But you can boil it down to three things. And so in order to grow a practice, you either win clients, you buy clients, or you make more profit. It really is that simple, yeah? Yes, there's variations, and you can charge more money and provide services, but those are the things. And it's ultimately, do you want to grow, yes or no? Do you want to increase your profitability? Do you want to get more life outside of your business? Great. Let's go do that. And it really, really is that simple. So I think the growth side of things, it's not about winning clients for the sake of clients. Accountants have become trapped, and they are victims of their own success. They've won too much work with the wrong fit type of clients. It keeps them so busy. There's so many legislative changes coming through that they need to be reactive to, additional work that they need to do, and it keeps them trapped and locked. Great. Well, why are you winning more of the wrong clients as opposed to winning the ideal types of clients that you actually want to work with? Why are you winning businesses that are going to about price, whereby you could be dealing with others that are a lot more profitable for you? You're able to provide more value-add services, and actually, as a result of it, takes you less time. Would your team not appreciate that? Great. So, firms have a problem with attrition, yeah? So I'm losing this member of staff, I'm losing that member of staff. Why? Well, it's either the personal needs of the individuals not being met, they don't feel heard and appreciated, or it's a case of they're too busy, they're too overworked, or even you're not paying them enough. Sometimes it's a combination of all three. So if you've got the ideal types of clients, then you've got enough money to pay them. They're also dealing with clients that respect and appreciate them, therefore their life inside of work is better. They've also got less work constantly on their plate, whereby they have to work late hours, early mornings, great. So your attrition problem isn't the fact that you're not a good employer. It's the fact you've got the wrong clients and you don't have enough money to be able to look after your people, right? Quite literally, D, everything boils down to every problem, every budget, every investment that needs to be made in future-proofing the firm with regards to automation and AI and everything else around it. Every single problem is solved by getting the right type of clients and making enough profit from them, because then you've got the time, the headspace, the energy, and most importantly, the budget to be able to do something about your other problems.
I totally get that. You're in, and you go in there and you can, but there's a difference between saying that and the doing of it. There's a quantum leap they have to make from where they are now to where they want to be. And there's a gap there that you're going to fill, because they brought you in because they absolutely need you to provide that level of enlightened thinking. I call it the art of common sense, and common sense is only there if you've got the stripes on your shoulders and you work jolly hard and perfected your craft. So yours as a person being able to be brilliant at sales. So you've set that scene. Then you presumably you've got to then determine the how, haven't you? Looking at that practice, do you find there are common denominators in that how, given you're in this accountancy sector? Are there things that you think, yeah, I'm pretty sure that if we take these actions, it's going to move us closer to this ideal client scenario?
Absolutely. The how ultimately comes after the why. So you can engage with somebody, have that conversation. And what happens all too often, and it's not the fault of a firm, they think something's a good idea. They invest time, effort, and energy in understanding what that might look like and doing something about it, yet become too busy to actually devote any headspace and are very reluctant to change, right? So I think before we get to the how, we need to get buy-in from the why. And that needs to be everyone, not just equity holders or equity partners within the firm, but right the way down any form of change management project, which is ultimately like anything you ever do requires change management. Absolutely. Whether it's a very small amount or it's a very large amount, everyone being bought in typically determines the project success or not. And it doesn't matter what that project is, but you need to have everyone bought in, from a client managers, practice managers, seniors, partners, directors, whoever is going to be involved, right the way throughout the course of that project. And that's whether it's implementing a new piece of software, shaking up your marketing and sales, where it comes to having an offshore team being brought in and creating an increase in profitability and alleviating bottlenecks within your firm. It doesn't matter. The why has to be there. The how from a vendor's side, really, really simple. We call it a success plan or a success story. Ultimately, we aren't a customer-supplier relationship. We aren't subservient to either side. We're here to do this together. We've got a shared goal. We get that goal right and everyone's brought into that. Great. Here's a documented plan. Super simple. Who owns it? Is it you? Is it us? Who's reliant on the other party doing what? When does that need to be completed by? And we never deviate from the plans that we put in place with clients. Accountability is such an important thing. And so many people can have a fluffy, a nice high-level conversation, but the action behind it and the 8% of people that actually do what they say they're going to do, that doesn't exist within every type of business. And we like to be completely different to that, break the mold, and make sure we are not only accountable to our clients, but our clients are accountable to us. And the accountability part of this, D, that's critical, especially when you're so busy. You've been pulled left, right, and center, pulled back into client work, pulled back into staff changes, operational stuff. You can't really focus on one thing in particular. You have to be a master of everything in a firm if you're a director or partner. So the accountability part of it, and somebody being tenacious enough to say, hey, here's the impact of your actions. If we don't do this like you said it was going to be done, do you want to suffer with the impact, or do you want to get things back on track? And sometimes it does need that tenacity.
I think that's an absolutely brilliant answer, and it's something as a marketer that I massively identify with when I've gone into a business and it's like, I can pull all manner of rabbits out the hat. I can see why your marketing's not working. But if you're not going to commit to a plan, this ain't going to happen. So I agree, getting the buy-in of everybody. And that's why I always have meetings where the whole team is involved once I've gone in there to do my diagnostic. And so I think I spoke about it at an event that we were both speaking at recently, the, what's it called, the TAG conference. That it's time over money, that you really need to invest time. And I think bringing in an expert like you, it doesn't just make them accountable, which is really important. It also makes them respect the advice that you're giving them because they've created the space that you have insisted upon for that to happen. Now, I'm conscious. I'm just thinking I'm going to have to get you back on for another show because I just love to do a show in which you share your sales insights because you've got so much of that value that my listeners would love. But I want to ask you, before we talk about you being a dad, I want you to, can you share a few simple sales tips for our readers that would work irrespective of what they do?
Yeah, sure. I think firstly, on what you've just said, Dee, what a very cool thing to say. I really appreciate that. Very kind. Keeping it relevant. I think great sales boils down to three things. Number one is good human energy. Number two is credibility. And number three is authority, or in some cases, trust, right? So point number one, good human energy, as I refer to it. If somebody likes you, or if somebody doesn't like you, if they don't like you, are they ever going to buy from you? Great. So be nice, be you, be real. If you're a bit grumpy, if you're a bit sarcastic, if you, you know, can say things like that with a smile on your face, great. But be your genuine and authentic self. If people do not buy from you because they do not like you, that's okay. It's a big world. We're not all meant to like and get on with each other. But if they do like you, they do get on with you, that might be a really good thing and a really good sign, because actually you need to be able to work with that individual potentially on an ongoing basis. And if you can't be yourself, you're going to end up becoming sick. So if people don't like you for who you are, if you can't, with your good human energy, at least have an equal playing field with them, maybe they're not right for you and you're not right for them. Secondly, around the credibility, authority, like, let's put all these things together, the trust side of things. Great sales has a very important fallback, and it's the thing that so many businesses miss. Especially accountants, Dee, like, they do a phenomenal job. And you ask an accountant about their business, they're not necessarily forthcoming. But you ask them about the work that they do for a client's business, and they'll chew your ear up all day, right?
Yeah.
They spend so much more time on their clients' businesses as opposed to their own. So the important thing to be able to bring together is what we call in the marketing world social proof. What type of business have you solved a problem for? What was their problem? Where were they at? What problem did you solve? What was the benefit in overcoming that problem? And where is the business now? You know, these assets, if you would, can be captured in various different ways, whether those be incorporated into newsletters, incorporated into blogs on your website, case studies, short form video content, longer form video content, and things like podcasts, right? But where can you get that credibility from the existing businesses that you work with to be able to document and share that with your prospective clients in a way that's non-invasive? Because think about it this way, like, as business owners, Dee, we're all buyers. I'm going to say I'm great. You're going to say you're great. Anyone listening that owns a business is going to say they're great, but they're biased, because if they win that business, they benefit from it. And that's okay. That's no problems at all. But who's not biased? Our clients. And Dee said, you said something so wonderful earlier on. You've heard about me from a peripheral level. You've heard about what we do. More importantly, you've heard the stories from our clients, which then really gives us credibility, because that's the most important thing that we could ever share. What do the consumers of our products, of our services, what do they have to say? That's what we should be putting front and center where it comes to not only our marketing, but also our sales conversations and navigating the storytelling through that asset, right?
I couldn't agree more with you. I think, and I was thinking about why I invited you on the show, and I think it was meeting you that we'd sort of like chatted on LinkedIn, but meeting you was a whole different thing. I just saw that you were warm and friendly. And when I say human, that sounds kind of weird, but you weren't robotic. You were just a warm, friendly human being. And that's what I'm always drawn to. And then I will dig deeper into the competence of somebody. But we've got a minute, and I saw the most beautiful photograph of your wife, who's just gorgeous. And she's pregnant. You've got a baby due. Mm-hmm. Well, we've got a minute. Just tell me what being a dad, becoming a dad, means to you.
My greatest achievement in life isn't a business, isn't a house, a car, and a bank balance. It's being a dad.
Yeah, I agree. It's the same with me as a mum. And I know you're going to have a wonderful time. I've seen your posts on LinkedIn about the baby and your wife and those gorgeous photographs. And so I know that me and my listeners will be wishing loads of luck and love to you in the months and the weeks, the months and the years ahead. Now, we're at that part in the show, James. I could have chatted to you. This is where I almost wish I had like a couple of hours and we could talk about sales, but you never know. I always say when I form a connection with somebody, you just never know where it's going to lead to. I'm not looking for work. I like to accumulate great people, because then I can dip into my bag and think, oh, that person is just perfect in this situation. So you never know where this is going to end. But we're at the part of the show now where you can ask me a question, and I never know the question that I'm going to be asked. And I've not been stuttering and, you know, floundering today, but there's always a first time. So hit me with your question.
Thank you, Dee. So I want to take a step, not completely outside of the business world with this, but I think for a lot of directors and business owners, the lines between work and life and growing and succeeding in business versus growing and succeeding in life outside of can be a very difficult thing to balance. You have had, and I'm sure your listeners will have obviously gained this over many, many episodes, but you've had an incredible career, which will no doubt continue on. You've achieved some great things personally outside of work as well. And I think I'd love to have you share with your listeners, Dee, how do you strike that balance? How do you ensure that life and life beyond a job title is able to thrive whilst also being able to build incredible brands, incredible business, and an incredible career with that?
Wow, life outside of work. So there's kind of pre-slowing down and where I am now. And so I've got to be honest that in my sort of early to mid years, my work life balance was sketchy because my husband gave up his job. He was unhappy, deeply unhappy. And I became the breadwinner. And so I was probably very much like you shared so candidly earlier on, that you don't really have a work-life balance. But I think you need to accept that there are certain stages when you're growing a business that it's idealistic to assume that you're going to strive this perfect balance. And if you do, then you're going to put yourself under this huge pressure of, why am I not doing more of this outside of work? So I would say that most definitely when I was building the business and when I was writing books, I didn't have a healthy work-life balance. You can't write, my books, I've been blessed, have sold really well all over the world, but you can't write very good books if you're striving to just work from 9 till 3, then spend 2 hours of your day before you step into home life. That just doesn't happen. So in the years when I was building my business, it didn't happen. And then I became quite ill. I got a very insidious form of tinnitus, and that made me strive for a better work-life balance. There's nothing quite like having a medical condition imposed upon you to make you realize you're at that fork in the road. You either venture down the road of, I'm going to carry on and ignore it, and eventually you will have a breakdown, or you say, this is an opportunity now for me to take stock. So that was when I pulled back a bit. And now with my life now, I've gone into magazine production, for example, which is not as onerous as it sounds, because it draws on my skills. And I found myself recently working till midnight. And that's okay. because I build in pit stops to go out with my husband. He's retired. We make time to go out for lunch, go out for coffee. And so I'm a consummate juggler and I never get it quite right, James. But by accepting that is the nature of my life, I'm not putting upon myself a set of conditions that I'm going to end up thinking, why are you not doing this? Because I feel that criticizing yourself over stuff that you really should be more accepting of is different to criticizing yourself over stuff that you really do need to take to task. And I think, as you know, I'm a recovering alcoholic with, I've got 27 years of sobriety now, and that's been fundamental in shaping my life so that I'm a good mum, you know, a really good mum, good granny, good wife, good businesswoman, that I pretty much, I tick those boxes. Some days those boxes have got a bigger tick than others, but that's okay. We're perfectly imperfect, aren't we, at this game of life. We're doing our best. And that's as much as we can hope for, especially if you're obviously a very enlightened, self-aware human being, as am I. And so, yeah, that's my answer. How does that sound?
I love that. We're all just houseplants with complicated emotions, aren't we? And we're all just figuring it out. I love that. Like, thank you for the, I guess, the rawness of what you've just shared. Like, there will be so many of your listeners, no doubt, that feel in that same situation. And I think so many people put them pressure on themselves and perceive what other people are doing in these perfect, ideal lives that you see on social media, for example, and go, hey, like, that's not me. Like, what's going on? Like, I've been in business for 20 years. You know, when does that happen for me? And yeah, I love that, Dee. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, James, it's been an absolute joy having you on my show today. I will have you back because I just feel that we didn't scratch the surface, but I always think with my guests, there's more story that needs to be told. So we'll stay in touch. But I just want to thank you for being on the show today. Lots of love and luck with your lovely wife and your new baby.
I appreciate that so much. Thank you so much for having me once again, Dee.
What a lovely show that was with James Sundin. And I'm sure that so much of what he shared has resonated with you. I think what really stuck out for me was I loved his story of knocking on those doors and his tenacity and his resilience. I loved his explanation of he didn't want depleted mental energy. And I really liked the way that James approaches his work with clients. So I would encourage you, just reflect on what James had said today. Are you approaching tasks with depleted mental energy? Should you be more positive and uplifted about yourself and all the amazing skills and attributes that you bring to the table? So I will end the show, as I always do, by saying you're capable of so much more than you give yourself credit for. You've probably got loads of untapped potential. So give yourself a big warm hug, stand in your circle of power, and face this big, brave world, knowing you are more than enough for the tasks that lie ahead. Until next week, that's me, Dee, signing off on Lead Well, Live Well on UK Health Radio. You've been listening to Lead Well, Live Well on UK Health Radio.